The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
Hello, I'm Alex Kratosky, and welcome to a special edition of the show dedicated to a book by author and celebrated digital dystopian, Andrew Keen. In The Internet Is Not the Answer, Keen sets out to disrupt what he perceives as a deluded view of the internet. Andrew Keen, welcome to Tech Weekly.
Thank you, Alex, for having me.
Well, I'm going to open with a quote that I think bluntly sets up your position before diving into some of the enfant terrible that not only comes out of the pages of this, but you as sort of what you represent within the internet community. So here's the quote, get ready. The Ministry of Truth is backed in business. In Silicon Valley, everything is the opposite of what is claimed. The sharing economy is really the selfish economy. Social media is, in fact, antisocial. The long tail of cultural democracy is actually a long tail, spelled T-A-L-E. Free content is turning out to be shatteringly expensive, and the success of the internet is, in truth, a huge failure. Epic fucking fail. Well, obviously, with a statement like that, Andrew, it's, you know, I don't even need to ask why you have become the enfant terrible of the internet. But I want to take a step back.
But I'm not. You said I was dystopian, which I don't think I am.
You don't think you're a dystopian, though. Though what you present in your work often has a dystopic element. For example, in the introduction to this book, you say that the internet is not the answer, not yet, anyway. And I wonder what needs to change in order for the future that you lay out in the book not to happen. So you do have dystopic elements of your oeuvre.
Yeah, but the classic dystopian text would be the two books that obviously come to mind for most of us are Brave New World and 1984. And I don't think my book is that dark. I wish it was.
You can always work harder, Andy.
I'm going to do a really dark book next time around.
Are you? I can only.
A true dystopian text.
And it's going to be published online. Well, actually, but taking the step back, why do you think that you feel, or why do you think that people feel that you pose a threat to the internet community?
People? Like?
Well, the internet community. You know, Andrew Keen is brought in to often counter the utopian perspective about the internet.
Yeah, Alex, I mean, that's a generous, you're generously inflating my significance, which I think I would disagree with as not an arrogant person. But I actually think it's interesting that there's been a shift. When I wrote Cult of the Amateur in 2007, which was my first book, and was extremely polemical because it suggested that Web 2.0 was a failure, that it was creating a sort of a cultural disaster, creating all this free content and undermining the professional creative class. And I was, at that point, really vilified. Then I was, to quote you, the enfant terrible. But now, 7 years later or 8 years later, I think the zeitgeist has shifted actually dramatically. And I think, not that I'm putting words in your mouth, but people like yourself, who would have been critical of Cult of the Amateur in 2007, are actually much more sympathetic. I think there is a general, not a consensus, but a shift in the middle ground. I mean, you've always got the hardcore utopians, the Kevin Kellys of the world, the Jeff Jarvises, who whatever happens are going to defend digital. But you've got people like yourself. I mean, John Norton reviewed my book very kindly, who are beginning to realize that all the things they thought the internet would solve are actually compounding. So I think there's a shift. I don't think I'm not necessarily happy about this because people are agreeing with me. People are coming up saying, I read your book and I really agree with you. And I'm not used to that. I'm thinking, oh my God, they're not going to buy the book. Maybe I should have written something really offensive. Now my next book, maybe I should be defending the internet.
Well, actually, what was your motivation for writing the internet is not the answer. Who were you seeking to be your audience?
Not your audience, not the people listening to this, I'm afraid.
But if they wish to buy it, then I'm sure it's available.
Of course, absolutely, and don't steal it. Although I'm sure most of your audience are intellectual thieves, are they?
Of course they are.
You don't charge for this on The Guardian. And as you know, I can't believe you even had me on the show, because I go after The Guardian saying you guys still don't have a business model.
We're happy to embrace our critics.
Literally.
If you wish. And that's for the video cast later.
What was the question?
See, we riffed and now you've forgotten. What was your motivation for writing?
Oh, the motivation for writing the book.
And also which audience did you have in mind?
That's a good point. So as you guys know, I'm sure you celebrated on the show, 1989 was the 25th anniversary. Berners-Lee created the web in 1989. So last year we celebrated 25th anniversary of the web. But I wanted to go back further. I wanted to write a history of the internet. What is this thing we call the internet? We all have different versions of what it is and what it isn't. So the first two chapters of the book really focus on a history. And I figured that some people, like my frenemy Jeff Jarvis, say that the internet's still too young to make a judgment. It's a baby, it's a pre-adolescent. But I actually don't think it is. So I figured that the first computer-to-computer communication was in 1969. So in 3 or 4 years, we're going to be celebrating the 50th anniversary, really, of the internet. The idea of the internet, of course, existed in the 1940s. I go back to Vannevar Bush, who imagined it as the first person to have a coherent vision of what it was. But I think after 50 years, and certainly after 25 years of the web, we're at a point where we can really evaluate it in overall terms. The book was written for a broad audience. I don't think that technology technology has escaped from its ghetto. We remember in the old days, technology books, technology discussions were at the back of the bookstore, in the back of the room. Today, technology has taken center stage. It's changed media. It's changing transportation. It's changing healthcare and education. The digital storm, as you know this better than I do, is now challenging and shattering and undermining every traditional 20th century industry. So for me, I wanted to write a book that a teacher, a cab driver, a parent, a doctor, an accountant, a lawyer, every industry, every profession that is being radically undermined by this, obviously creative people, musicians, filmmakers, journalists, that they could all make sense of and understand how this world, how this technological revolution, which I think is as equivalent in its historic significance to the Industrial Revolution at the beginning of the 19th century, how it was affecting them. And if there are people who are listening to this who don't think the digital revolution is going to affect them, they're fundamentally wrong and they should be deeply concerned, because every industry, every profession, every form of identity is being radically changed and undermined by the digital revolution.
And that is the point at which we can talk about dystopia and utopia. The utopians would argue that it's being radically undermined, it's being transformed, it's being disrupted for the better. A dystopian would argue, as in many places you do in your book, that it's actually that it is undermining, it is destroying industry.
Yeah, I think we need to come up with better terms, because I think it's too easy to allow this conversation, which is the key conversation, I think, of our age, inside and outside tech, to degenerate into dystopian versus utopian. For example, in the book, I make a real effort to quote a lot of digital optimists. Let's use optimist versus pessimist. I think it's a better dichotomy. But, I quote Fred Wilson on the development of monopolies. Fred Wilson, who's no friend of mine, has been very critical of me. In fact, he got invited to one of my book parties in New York and was outraged that my friend was holding it for me. So he's no friend of mine. I quote Jeff Jarvis. He's a friend, but we never agree on anything, talking about how the internet has been corrupted by a lack of civility. I talk about Clay Shirky, again, a friend, but someone we don't always agree on, who talks about the tragedy of unemployed journalists. I quote Mike Moritz, again, one of the most distinguished venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, who warns us about data factories and the inequality of the new digital economy. So it's not just me. I think that more and more people who have historically been, shall we say, optimists, people who believe the best of the digital revolution, are beginning to understand that there is a dark side and they're becoming pessimists. I mean, even Marc Andreessen, who was the poster boy of the first wave of internet innovation, the first basically internet boy millionaire with Netscape, even he now is worried about stuff. Even he's refusing to invest in anonymous networks like Secret. So I think there is a sense of decay and crisis. You see it particularly in the debates over Uber and its moral failings. I mean, even Peter Thiel, who I'm very critical of, acknowledges that Uber is morally unacceptable. And of course, in the ongoing debates in Europe over Amazon and Google. So I would rather have the optimist versus pessimist rather than utopian versus dystopian, because I don't think there are many utopians or dystopians really in this debate.
Well, in fact, I think there's more of a middle ground than even the dichotomy that you're proposing. Because if we are looking at this technology that has been around for 50 years and we've sort of achieved an understanding of in many ways how it interacts and what it does in quotes to us, then now is a time to have a more reasoned debate as opposed to create polarized arguments between what something is doing to us for good or for ill. So why not engage in that kind of middle ground debate?
Absolutely. But do you think I did with the book or not? Because I did make an effort. I mean, clearly it's polemical. You read out one of my grenades. but on the other hand, it's certainly a more reasoned or a more reasonable argument than, say, Cult of the Amateur, which was a single grenade designed to cause as much damage and controversy as possible. This is, I think, a more balanced book. And as you say at the beginning, firstly, I acknowledge that I like the internet as much as anyone. I'm wired. I'm not a reactionary. I'm as connected as anyone. And this is our reality. The internet has to become the answer. It's not the answer yet, but it may do one day. And if it isn't, then we're all in huge trouble. I compare it again to the Industrial Revolution. I tried to be as historical as possible. I got my undergraduate degree in history, which was quite useful in terms of this book. And I think we do need to think historically. We need to understand that we need to learn from, say, the Industrial Revolution, because if we were having this argument in 1812, Walter Isaacson famously talks about Lord Byron and his famous Luddite speech in Parliament, you would have Luddites, and I'm not a Luddite, but sometimes people think of me as one, and we would be talking about the impact of industrialization on children, child labor, pollution, and these were all credible, and it took a century for these things to work itself out. Data is the new pollution. These are huge issues. They're not going to be resolved in 20 minutes, and the other cultural problem with the internet is Douglas Rushkoff wrote an excellent book on this, The Tyranny of the Present. Jaron Lanier famously says he misses the future. Rushkoff talks about the tyranny of the present. I miss the past. So I think we need to think not only historically, but also in terms of the future. We need more distance. And I hope that my book will be helpful in terms of giving people more perspective. It's not just something that can be summarized in 140 characters and hashed out to excuse the pun on Twitter.
Well, we're going to get more deeply into some of these questions in just a minute. But first, speaking of history, I'm going to quote another passage from your book. The history of the internet, which certainly appears to be as random and chaotic as any story ever told, is actually two simple stories. Tell us those stories.
Well, the first story is the internet as an academic, scientific project begun mostly out of the defense community, coming out of the end of the Second World War with Vannevar Bush and this very curious guy called Norbert Wiener, who invented the science of cybernetics. They sort of represent that the founding fathers, I think, of the internet, through to the Cold War and the desire to protect the American telephone system from a Soviet attack, which resulted in the packet sharing technology and geniuses like J.C.R. Licklider, who sponsored the development of a computer system, a computer network that would allow what he called human computer symbiosis. all this was done under the aegis of the government or under universities, scientific sponsorship in the principle of the public interest. All this, and Berners-Lee, of course, represents one bookend of this, and Berners-Lee was the classic example of a publicly spirited scientist committed to the public good, not interested in personal profit, who not only invented the World Wide Web, but then gave it away to the public, wasn't even interested in creating any IP around it. So I think Berners-Lee epitomizes that selfless scientist. Very distinguished, smart, publicly spirited people who thought that they were doing good. And then, of course, what happened in the early 90s with the success of the web, with the World Wide Web, you had changes in the law in Washington, D.C. in terms of the way in which the web was seen. So it shifted from this nonprofit to a commercial enterprise. And you had, of course, the bubble of the 90s, Netscape, AOL, and the rest of the madness. So you have this second period of intense commercialism, enormous creation of wealth from AOL and Netscape and Yahoo through to Google and Facebook and Twitter and all the other startups we know today. Now, just to be clear on that, I'm more sympathetic to the first period because I think it was purer. And I have more respect for a Berners-Lee than I do for a Mark Zuckerberg. On the other hand, I think, just as we talked about these sort of Manichaean extremes of dystopia and utopia, I think there needs to be a balance. Because I'm not necessarily idealizing a non-market internet. I don't think we can go back and sort of create a socialist internet, if you like, or a publicly owned internet, a Guardian or BBC, and not that the Guardian is a non-profit. That was my little joke. or a BBC, a BBC-style internet, publicly funded, versus the American free market model. I think particularly in things like the network neutrality debate, many people don't understand that the internet has a history, that it wasn't just delivered by a stork in the middle of the night to the people because we were virtuous and we deserved it. It has a very concrete social and economic and political history. And some people would indeed be uncomfortable with the idea of it coming out of the military-industrial complex, coming out of the Cold War, coming out of the Rand Corporation and other Defense Department contractors. So there's a complex political dimension to this as well. And I think we need to know the history of the internet because, like anything else, it has a concrete social and economic and ideological history too.
And it's baked into the technology.
Right,
as well.
It's baked into the technology. And that's one of the things that I really address is the idea that it was believed that because the internet wasn't the old top-down hierarchy, that it was that the packet technology was predicated on distributed nodes, no center, all edge, so that it would be protected against the Soviet attack on the American communications system. It was believed, and it was believed by a whole generation of thinkers, you know, from Kevin Kelly to John Perry Barlow to Chris Anderson to Jeff Jarvis to Clay Shirky to many others, that because this was a distributed system, because it had no center, because it did away with the old industrial hierarchies, that would be reflected in its economic and political structure. And I think this is one of the central, if not the central argument in my book.
Absolutely.
Is that not because the internet people are evil, it's one of the ironies, it's an unintended consequence, but the network effect of this distributed structure actually lends itself in many ways more to monopoly, an oligarchy, and a winner-take-all economy than the old top-down system. In the old world, we had Hertz and Avis. We usually had a kind of an oligarchy, 2, 3, 4 dominant companies. In the digital winner-take-all economy, we usually just have one. We have a Google, we have a Facebook, we'll have an Uber, we'll have an Airbnb, but you don't really have much competition, not because the internet's bad or because internet entrepreneurs are bad, but because of the network effect of this distributed structure, it lends itself to monopolies.
But is this not an anglophilic analysis of the internet? There are different systems.
Anglophilic?
Well, there are different interests, there are different organizations in different parts of the world that use the internet. So rather than just focus on individual...
No, I think that's wrong, Alex. I think that, you could talk about China or Russia, which are closed systems and have their own state-invested or state-controlled internet monopolies. But look at Google's impact and success in Europe. I mean, I don't see many successful European companies. I think Google now has over 90% of the search market in Europe, which is more than in the US. So I think one of the other issues is the US-centric nature of the internet and the way in which almost all the dominant internet companies have come out of America. And even the European ones that have been successful have tended to migrate one way or the other to Europe.
Why is that a problem?
But I'm just responding to your idea that I failed to take into account the diversity of markets. The reality of the internet is there isn't really a diversity of markets. I mean, you can always find an app company in Finland or France or Spain or Africa, but they don't have any impact. They don't get any traction. That's one of the problems, is it's very hard to fight these new monopolies. It's very hard to compete.
And is that why the decentralized capitalism of the internet actually makes us poorer rather than makes everyone richer?
Well, it's disappointing because we hoped that distributed capitalism would lend itself to what, you know, Thomas Friedman famously called the flat world, where everyone would have an equal opportunity. Now, it's true to say that in 1998, everyone had the opportunity to become Google. But there was a lottery winner, two very brilliant young men, Sergey and Larry, who came up with the idea of indexing the internet and essentially taking it over and creating a brilliant search engine. So anyone could have been Larry and Sergey. I mean, if you were smart enough and lucky enough to go to Stanford and have their intellectual and financial resources. But once they took control, then that was it.
How would it have been different, though, if it hadn't been Larry and Sergey? How could, can you, you know, sort of thought experiment
that one
out for me?
Well, that's a great question, because you'd think if we could stop the clock in 1999 and say, okay, we're going to have this, because in 1999 there wasn't a dominant internet company. We thought there were. We thought there was Yahoo and AOL, but they were early examples of old-style media companies that got an early advantage on the internet and now are essentially irrelevant. I think Google is the first real internet company, as I explain in the book. And if we were being able to look into the future and we were doing this conversation in 1998, 1999, and we were to say, okay, this is going to be the dominant internet company. It's going to control search and many other markets, including mobile, mapping, video, right across the board. Now they're doing their roll-up in artificial intelligence. And it's going to be founded by a couple of really idealistic young guys, very, very smart, in their early 20s, good senses of humor, very worldly, very committed, since we're at The Guardian, to liberal values, especially Sergey. Hostile to advertising. This product would be so pure that they wouldn't even allow advertising on their homepage. Proud of the fact that they didn't have a business model, not interested in making money. We'd have rubbed our hands and thought, wow, this internet thing is going to be brilliant. It's going to be like The Guardian. It's going to be this wonderful, huge, thriving, rich nonprofit. So that's, of course, the irony is what happened, and I tell the story of Google in part of the book, is not because these guys are evil. The whole idea of, you know, Google being good or evil is an absurdity. It's no better or worse in moral terms than any other large multinational corporation. But the unintended consequences of these guys being swept up in venture money and getting a grown-up like Eric Schmidt to run the show and then discovering the holy grail of advertising and essentially turning the internet into a vast advertising platform for themselves. So it shows how ironic the history of the internet is, how hard it would have been to actually predict what would happen. Because these are good guys, and I think they remain good guys. I think particularly Sergey are very much committed to the public good. They're not, you know, I think some of the internet entrepreneurs like Mark Zuckerberg are a bit creepy, a bit slimy, but I don't think they are. But it shows the way in which they're almost hostages to the forces. Now, as I say in the book, and I think this is why you could go back to the thought of the internet having two histories, Sergey and Larry were very much like, in terms of their brilliance, their eccentricity, their commitment to the public good, they were very much like the Vannevar Bushes, the JCR Licklaters, the Norbert Wieners. They were intellectually brilliant, very much committed to the idea of technology and the public good. Had they been around in the 50s or 60s, they would have, or Berners-Lee, they would have been pioneers, architects of the original web, and wouldn't have made a lot of money. So I think with Google, you have a lot of the paradoxes of history, of the way in which we're never quite in control of history as we'd like to think we are.
You mentioned Zuckerberg. There are, of course, other examples that you raise in the book. You talk about Instagram, for example. Do they represent, do these young entrepreneurs represent the future? Do they represent the second half?
Well, I represent Google. I have a chapter on Instagram in comparison with the chapter on Kodak. For me, Kodak is the epitome of an industrial company, employed 145,000 people, was run by a guy called George Eastman, who was very much committed to the public good. Whereas Instagram, of course, sold to Facebook famously at the time for $1 billion. It seemed like a lot of money, not now with the WhatsApp acquisition. But when it sold for $1 billion, we had this shift from, in the book I call the shift from the Kodak to the Instagram moment in history. Instagram employed about 35 people. So what we have is this shift from an industrial factory economy where people were paid to work in factories and created things which were then sold, a monetary economy, to the data factory economy, where we're all working for Instagram, but we don't get any of the upside, which is one of the deep concerns in the book about employment. I don't think Kevin Systrom is any worse than anyone else. Again, we're all prisoners. I am critical of Zuckerberg because I think he is blatantly hypocritical. I mean, everyone is a little hypocritical, including myself. No one is completely consistent. But I think Zuckerberg is particularly troubling in the sense that he talks about openness and transparency and wiring up the world. And of course, his only interest is really profiting Facebook. He has discovered the idea of the public good, of utility, of connectivity and transparency, but it benefits Facebook. And I have this, I don't have the story in my book, but I think it's a helpful sort of story of a metaphor of what's gone wrong with this revolution. At Kodak, George Eastman had a lovely mansion in Rochester, and on a Saturday morning, he would open this mansion up to the local community to give free classical music concerts. Now, he was a rich man, and he was slightly odd, and I'm not idealizing him, but he was very much committed to giving back to the local community. And indeed, when you go to Rochester now, as I did for the book, whilst the economics of Rochester has been decimated, well, there's a big, it's a donut-shaped place where there's a hole in the middle where there really isn't anyone, where there's no unemployment. There still is a very thriving music college and a local university, which was all funded by Eastman. So there is still some relics of that civic investment that Eastman gave. Zuckerberg, in contrast, bought a beautiful house in San Francisco, as is his right, and then bought the three adjoining houses, which he turned into a cordon sanitaire for his own privacy. So here you have a guy whose public utterances are all about transparency and openness and connectivity, and his private life is a dramatic contrast. So he's not honest, and I think that's my trouble with someone like Zuckerberg and many of the others. In Travis Kalanick of Uber, they talk about disruption as if it's a public good, but they're doing it for their own private interest, which is nothing in itself bad, but it's just gratingly hypocritical.
We've spoken quite a lot about the capitalist motivations, the commercial motivations of the web, but then there are also other motivations that you touch on in the book, for example, within education. There's the movement towards MOOCs. There's the movement of taking things online. Talk about what you see as some of the problems, the issues arising from that movement, that migration of something that is arguably a civic entity to the online environment.
Well, we think of education as civic. And it is, in a sense, of course, because without education, we really are screwed. And in the, you know, it's still for the most part a public enterprise. But I think that the online education business is prone to exactly the same problems as media. In media, we were told that the long tail and the democratization of media would lead to more opportunity. But actually, the lack of a business model has led to the decimation of old media and the creation of tiny new platform monopolies. And rather than the long tail, rather than a thriving kind of cultural world, we actually have more and more of a blockbuster economy, a tiny group of superstars, a decimation of the middle, and then a long tail, but it's a kind of a lumpen proletarian or precariat tail rather than proletarian, underemployed or unemployed people giving away their stuff for free or trying to win the lottery.
Well, I'm going to ask a question that I asked before, which is, what is your motivation for writing this? Are you seeking conversion? Are you seeking an army?
This is one of the great issues of our age. I'm trying to write about the world, trying to explain what's going on. Every industry now is changing dramatically, and I'm trying to make sense of it. I mean, I'm only interested in writing about stuff that's important. I'm not interested in writing about subjects that don't matter. So whilst I have a lot of anecdotes, and while I hope I have a strong narrative structure that gives the story some readability, I'm only interested in writing about stuff that matters to all of us, whether we read newspapers, whether we go to school, whether we teach in school, whether we drive cabs, whether we run hotels, whether we're renting rooms out in our house. This is changing everything.
And what is it then that you hope will be inspired? What do you hope will come from this? Because if the internet is not the answer, but it will be, I don't know if that what it will be is something to be feared or something to be embraced or something that just is.
Well, firstly, I hope it will get people thinking about these issues. Secondly, these are issues that are currently becoming major political concerns. So we have a growing debate about Uber and Airbnb and the role of regulation in these new internet companies. We have a growing debate about data and our rights over data. So in the EU is pioneering the right to be forgotten law, which may or may not be viable, but I think is an important issue and will eventually mature into some sort of law. We have a growing debate about the role of Google as a monopolist, and indeed a debate about the relationship between innovation and regulation. Now, there are, in America in particular, there are a lot of people who argue that by definition, regulation is against innovation. And I think that's wrong. I think that to have real innovation, we need regulation. I was in DC a couple of weeks ago and I did my speech, and afterwards one of the FCC commissioners, Jessica Rosenworcel, came up and she said, yeah, I completely agree. We need regulation to encourage innovation. Let me just give you one example. Had Microsoft not been challenged in the courts, we never would have had Google.
Are you arguing for a top-down intervention or for a bottom-up intervention?
Well, as I've argued in the book, the idea of bottom-up, I think, is an illusion. I think that the role of government is important because I think that the alternative vision from Silicon Valley is the distributed system, the internet as the answer, or in Silicon Valley, the idea of the internet, which is essentially of an unregulated economy. So it's the Travis Kalanick vision of, let's just have the internet as the operating system for 21st century life. Let's just run everything off these dominant platforms, whether it's Airbnb or TaskRabbit or Google or Uber. And I think that that lends itself to the kind of Darwinian capitalism of the early 19th century. and we need a more balanced kind of system. And the only way you get balance is from government. I mean, there are some corporate self-regulations, which I talk about in the book. But for the most part, if government is no longer relevant, if we discard government, if we think government is the problem rather than the answer, then we are increasingly vulnerable to these companies. Then we have no defense. And I think we do need to think of government as a friend rather than a foe. And I think one of the great errors of, especially of Silicon Valley, is to see government as the problem rather than a partner.
I would argue that there's another error within Silicon Valley, which is its great hubris, the belief that such a thing as they are creating is something that has never come before. You said yourself that you have a history degree, and so therefore it's useful to look back in time. He said that nothing since the Industrial Revolution has shaken the foundations of our society. Well, what can we learn from the Industrial Revolution? What can we learn about the era of the printing press for what it is that this thing will do? Why must we think that this is something that is so revolutionary that everything has been completely upended? Surely we've seen a lot of this before?
Well, we have seen a similar kind of what you call hubris before. We saw it in the early part of the Industrial Revolution. We saw it with people who argued that government was the problem. We saw it in the consequences, child labor, pollution, the real hubris of the robber barons. So hopefully people can learn from that, that nothing is ever new. And the internet in some ways, of course, is radically new in the distributed kind of its economics. But the forces that it's unleashed, these monopolies, this new power, aren't new. You know, Moises Naim wrote a book called The End of Power, which is entirely wrong. It's no coincidence that Mark Zuckerberg chose that book as his first book for his reading group on Facebook. Power hasn't ended. It hasn't really even changed. It may have changed its structure, but we still have these huge dominant companies with massive profitability and power that are shaping our lives. That's why I like the comparison between the CEO of Kodak and Zuckerberg. But we can find examples, positive examples from, if not Silicon Valley, certainly from contemporary technology. Bill Gates, for example, is doing remarkably good work as a philanthropist. Mark Benioff of Salesforce, he may like his name on all his donations, but he is also doing good work. So there are some grown-ups in Silicon Valley. And people like Andreessen, I think, are beginning to grow up. So I'm not entirely pessimistic. I'm cautiously optimistic. You know, we can always use the example of Travis Kalanick as the epitome of a digital robber baron. But for every Travis Kalanick, you know, there's a Bill Gates, there's a Mark Andreessen, there's a Mark Benioff.
Are we not in danger of ignoring the social pulse if we simply turn to the technology and make it a scapegoat?
Well, I've really made an effort not to make the technology the scapegoat. The title might be a bit naughty, but titles have to be naughty to sell. And, you know, I could have called the book Epic Fucking Failure, which would have been even naughtier. I make an effort to explain that behind or beyond or underneath or above the technology are these much more relevant social, economic, political forces. Technology isn't the thing in itself. It's not the first mover. And that the relationship between technology and economics and politics and culture is so entangled now that it's hard to find the core. It's hard to see the technology as either the cause or an effect, because it's both. So I think we've got to get beyond, and I'm sure you're doing this on your show, get beyond seeing the internet just as technology. I think one of my, I wouldn't say regrets, but one of the things that I'm not 100% thrilled with is the word the internet. Because when you think of the internet now as a word, you think, well, it's tubes, it's connectivity, it's the World Wide Web. But when we think of industrialization today, we don't just think of technology. We think of politics, we think of culture, we think of economics. And either the word the internet has to change, we need to come up with a better word, network society, digital revolution, maybe someone will write a book with a really sexy title word, or the idea of the, our idea of the internet has to expand, deepen, broaden, so that when we talk about this thing we call the internet, we need to be talking about something that is changing every aspect of early 21st century life. And that's the goal of my book, is to explain how and why it's doing that.
Well, many thanks, Andrew Keene. The Internet is Not the Answer is published by Atlantic Books and is available on Amazon. I'm sure you're thrilled with that. Thank you very much for joining us this week. We'll be back with more analysis of all things technical and technological and digital next Wednesday. Remember, for breaking news, just go to theguardian.com/technology. But for me, Alex Grotowski, and producer Jason Phipps, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.